Welcome to CS50. This is the start of week two. I actually got an email just this weekend from one of our own TFs who had been here at last week's lectures when we talked about some of these more arcane topics, namely one called typecasting, which we'll look at in more technical detail today. But his email started as follows. Hi, David. You introduced the concept of typecast. Recall this is converting a char to an int or an int to a char last week and exemplified the importance of understanding the types of operators. In case you want to insist on this point one day, here's a video of an event that changed my life. I was 14 years old watching this on live TV. So what you're about to see is a video of Ariane 5, Flight 501. This was a European rocket. There were no humans on board this rocket. But at the risk of pulling up YouTube in class again, let me go ahead and show you exactly what this teaching fellow is referring to.
Décollage.
So there weren't, to be clear, any humans on board, but the explanation for this explosion, which wasn't all that many years ago, was this. Because of a different flight path, a data conversion from a 64-bit floating point value to a 16-bit signed integer value caused a hardware exception, more specifically an arithmetic overflow, as the floating point number had a value too large to be represented as by a 16-bit signed integer. As it was an unmanned flight, there were no victims, but the breakup caused the loss of four cluster mission spacecraft, resulting in a loss of more than US $370 million because of one line of code. So if you find yourselves getting hung up on some of the esoteric nature of some of the lower level syntax, realize that these really are just building blocks. They're doing far more interesting things, and certainly when you're actually coding real applications, far more important applications do arise. So I asked this teaching fellow if he could elaborate on, you know, why it was this actually changed your life. And he responded, I think that at first I was fascinated by space, and I wanted to engineer rockets and satellites. To me, computers and programs were amazing, but a toy, while the conquest of space was serious stuff. Progressively, however, as I was studying engineering and sciences in high school and then college, the memory of this event helped me realize that software engineering and computer science were much more noble than I initially thought. I think the reasons were three. One, software is useful enough so that some of it was in this rocket sent into space. Two, it is critical enough that a malfunction result in the rocket exploding. And three, writing software is actually such a craft that even these rocket engineers from all around Europe could get it wrong. It made software engineering and computer science a whole lot more valuable into my eyes. And he wasn't the only one. So we've linked to the Wikipedia article that discusses the real in-depth history of this particular story. But one part of the article concludes as follows. Flight 501's high-profile disaster brought the high risks associated with complex computing systems to the attention of the general public, politicians, and executives, resulting in an increased support for research in ensuring the reliability of safety-critical systems. So appreciate, if nothing else, that as you dive into your own problem sets, one this week, and into future problem sets, that even these small bugs absolutely can recur in the real world. And if you think about some of the PSET problems you're working on now, you know, your code might be this long or this long, a few dozen lines, maybe 100 at some point very soon. But if you're finding yourself having a bug with this line of code and this line of code, imagine what happens when you literally have to implement rocket ships and operating systems, which are millions of lines of code long. So thankfully, there are tools and there are other languages, and one of the goals of this course is to introduce you to progressively better and better approaches to design, to style, to correctness. And so by semester's end, it won't necessarily feel like you're struggling with these if conditions and loops so much, but you'll actually be thinking much bigger picture, and that will happen quite soon. What some of you might have seen as you came in today was a little something called ASCII-mation. This is free time to the extreme. This is someone having taken this idea of ASCII art, using ASCII characters, to actually represent not just pictures, but an actual movie. So this is his interpretation of the original Star Wars movie. I bring this up only because in problem set one for problem set one, will you dabble a little bit in this idea of ASCII art, but realize as semester progresses, will we very soon have more expressive graphical capabilities. In speaking of, What you'll find if you haven't poked around recently on the course's website is you. So we took all of your answers to problem set 0, where one of the demographic questions were, where is your hometown? Recall, we didn't ask for your home address, just your city, state, and country. And what we did was we used an off-the-shelf API, application programming interface, as it's called. The students last year, in fact, used this for one of the tail-end problem sets in the course. And we embedded a Google map in the course's website, and then we proceeded to represent each and one of you with a little marker. The projector in here is making this a little darker than it actually is on a real computer. But if we zoom in down here, we might see that Dapo is from Lagos, Nigeria. And if we click on any number of our other folks here, is he here now? You will see where each and every one of the 500 of you are from. So with that said, where are we going? So we're going to lunch this Friday, not all of us. But one of the traditions we've started in this course, because it's fairly large, is an opportunity on a semi-weekly basis to get to know some of the teaching fellows, the course assistants, myself. And so we have CS50 lunches, either in one of the dining halls or somewhere in the square. And we generally do this by RSVP, first come, first serve. And it's really just an opportunity for 20, 30, 40 of us to head somewhere and grab a bite together. So the form's not online yet. But starting tonight, if you are free this Friday at 1:15, PM, which is otherwise when lecture would be if we still had it on Fridays, just go to cs50.net/RSVP and think of this as just an opportunity to chat us up, ask about the course, talk about whatever. It's sort of very low-key and edible office hours. So we'll do that on occasion if you are interested. So problem set one is now out. If you haven't dived in yet, that's totally fine. I have great fondness for those who do, in fact, dive in at 7:01 p.m. on Friday nights, much like myself back in the day. But just a couple of comments on this. So last week got very arcane quickly. For those of you without prior programming backgrounds, all of a sudden we had this blinking prompt and a black and white terminal, and I was banging out code fairly rapidly, and it was fairly out of context, most likely, for all of you. So realize if you walked out of last week thinking, wow, Scratch just got harder, well, realize once you actually sit down with this week's PDF and walk yourself through the checkboxes, will you find that it's actually all very quite accessible. And you get familiar with the new interface soon. We'll see different interfaces over time. And so let me make an emphatic point here, too, especially as you do this PSET, if you are finding yourself a bit overwhelmed or if you're just feeling like there's a disconnect between what you heard in lecture and what you're expected to do, talk to us. Talk to me, drop me a note, attend office hours. There are any number of resources. And at the end of the day, please, if you're on that point thinking, damn, I really should not have signed that study card with this course on it, at least have a conversation with me. I would love to be your barrier between exiting the course altogether and just kind of sneaking away thinking this isn't for you. We can make it work for you. So what is this PSET all about? Well, there's essentially three noteworthy parts in each of the editions. In the standard edition, you are introduced to the candy machine that is free in the lounge in Maxwell Dworkin, which you are welcome to start frequenting. We'll occasionally hold some office hours there and hang out. But the challenge here is really just to get your hands dirty with Linux and with C. And what you'll find, even though the problem is relatively simple in concept, we challenge you to implement a program that allows you, the human, to guess how many Skittles are in a candy machine. You simulate this candy machine using some pseudo-random numbers, and we walk you through the process of generating pseudo-random numbers in a computer's memory, and then ultimately you, the human, get to interact with your own program. And for those of you who have prior backgrounds, you'll realize this is really just a warm-up exercise, if nothing else, to get you acquainted with a new environment, the cloud, with a new language, C, but then do the problems become a little more sophisticated. So for instance, the next question asks you to take on the role of a cashier. So it turns out that in the United States and in Europe and in other countries, usually the currency systems are designed in such a way that very naively can a cashier at a store, if they have 20s and 10s and 5s or the similarly labeled quarters, nickels, and dimes, if they're all in sorted order, that cashier can very mindlessly hand people change by just starting with the biggest denomination in the drawer and working his or her way on down, handing the person the amount of change they're due. And this is an algorithm that's generally thought of as greedy. In other words, if you literally take the biggest bill possible, a 20, but if you owe them, say, 30 bucks, you obviously don't want to take another 20. You then take a slightly smaller bite, but a big one, a 10. Do you ultimately hand that human being the fewest number of bills or the fewest number of coins? So what's nice is when greedy algorithms, which are generally really easy conceptually and to implement and to execute, what's really nice is when they're also optimal. But as you'll see in a moment, for the hacker version of this problem set, we throw a wrench into the works, and you don't necessarily have all of the bills and coins that you need. So in this program here, you are you implement a program that has to figure out how many quarters, how many dimes, how many nickels, how many pennies to hand someone given a finite amount of change. And it's going to reduce some of those basic building blocks from scratch. So some if conditions, some subtraction, maybe some variables. But this, too, will get you familiar with this new environment and this new language. And then we thought we'd try to get trendy. And so we pulled up isawyouharvard.com, Tej Tor's final project from CS50 last year. And we thought, wow, this is perfect. This is a graph. This happens to represent who is spotting whom on campus based on the data she's collected. And it's a really nice and really simple bar graph that we can plot. So we're not going to actually use the same API that Tej is using, which happens to come from Google. It, too, is free, just like the maps we looked at a moment ago. But we can simulate this using ASCII art, using characters on the keyboard to give the to give it a decent approximation of what a bar graph is. And so here will you be asked to ask the user for the number of people spotting whom based on gender, and then you'll plot this graph horizontally. And this is clearly going to involve some kind of looping structure, some conditions, maybe a bit of math, because we specify, too, how big the user's screen is going to be. So you're going to have to figure out the proportions accordingly. Now, those for you who decide to tackle the hacker edition of this PSET and realize this is generally the minority of the students in the class, anyone is comfortable less comfortable, more comfortable like is welcome to do this. Doesn't matter what you declared yourself as. You can decide week to week. We have the same warm-up exercise involving some candy for you, but then we hand you a credit card numbers. So in the second portion of the hacker edition, are you handed a definition of what it means to be a credit card number? It turns out these things have patterns, and there are algorithms, procedures with which you can verify if a credit card number is legit or not. And so in this part of the problem set, you implement a validity checker for credit cards to actually ascertain yes or no, this is a credit card, or this is just some random sequence of numbers that someone's trying to use to pay for something on the phone. And in the toward the tail end of the hacker edition, do you implement the same idea of graphing with some ASCII art this chart, but this chart, we compel you to rotate it 90 degrees. You actually have to make a vertical bar chart, which if you think about how you would implement this in a screen, thus far, we've only seen printf for printing to the screen, and printf's gotcha is that it pretty much prints line by line by line, which lends itself to horizontal bars. Print a row, print a row, print a row. But if now these bars are stacked up high, you're going to have to be a little more clever when it comes to figuring out when do you draw this bar versus this bar versus this bar, and that will be the hacker edition this week. So those PDFs are online. And just FYI, if you were one of those like me who downloaded the PDF for Hacker at 7.01 p.m., do re-download it because I screwed up in the middle of the night and I made the bars the wrong shape in the sample output. So grab the latest PDF. So what exists in the way of support? So we've echoed this multiple times. Help at cs50.net is manned by the CS50 staff, and our response times tend to be remarkably fast. But we, in the interest of economies of scale, what we also released this weekend is the course's discussion forums or bulletin boards. There's certainly redundancy in the types of questions we get because there are absolutely some frequently asked questions. So on the course's homepage now on the left-hand side will you find a link to discussions, aka help.cs50.net. Anytime henceforth you have a question that you think probably someone else might have, and it's not something that's particularly personal or particularly unique to your own code, absolutely turn to the bulletin board first for two reasons. One, to check if someone else has asked the same question. It's nicely browsable and searchable. You can save yourself some time, get an immediate response. Or two, post the question if you think it might benefit others. And we spell out in the homepage, in the main page of the discussion forums, you know, exactly where that line is between oversharing and asking the right kind of question. Posting a few lines of your code saying, here, I'm having trouble figuring this out. That's probably fine. Saying, here's my program, doesn't work, help, too much, right? The idea is to actually engage us more privately with such things, hence the email address. So let me, for just one moment, put on my scary voice. Now that we're at the start of the semester. So the course takes very seriously issues of academic honesty. It is very clearly spelled out in the course's syllabus, and for your convenience, we include it on the second page of every single problem set throughout the semester. It explains, as best we can, where that line is between collaborating and working and learning, working with and learning from your classmates, which is absolutely encouraged, and where that line is between actually taking their ideas, taking their code, and then presenting it as your own. As you'll see in the syllabus, and do read this paragraph if you haven't already, the line essentially boils down to it's absolutely okay to talk with your friends, talk with people in your section, stand up at a whiteboard together, sort of brainstorming ideas, writing things down in pseudocode, and tackling the problems conceptually together. But where we draw the line in the syllabus is don't go to the point of talking in exact C code. Don't look at the person's screen. And certainly don't say, hey, do you mind sending me your code? To be honest, almost every time there are instances of academic dishonesty in this course, it's not because it was this fine line between oversharing, talking a little too much. It was 2 a.m. and someone decided to just copy the code from their friend's computer. Their friend made the mistake of actually sending them their code in poor judgment. And it's those kinds of issues. So realize it's absolutely the type of course where it's a community. You're certainly encouraged to learn from and work with each other, but do mind that line. And in conclusion, in scary voice, I made a little animation. So, though that is the number of people this course has ad-boarded over the past several years, recent years. So this is perhaps more effective than anything I can say verbally. So realize we are computer scientists. Realize we maintain archives of all past problem sets that are submitted. Realize we have the capabilities to cross-check every problem set submitted against every other problem set submitted. We're very good at what we do, and it gives us no pleasure to escalate things to the administrative board, but we do it in fairness to your classmates who are really giving it their all. So, late days exist for a reason. When you're at that point at 2 a.m., when you're feeling yourself stressed or you've got so much else going on in your life, honestly, that's when you cash in the late day, go to bed, or worst case, reach out to me or Jansu or Yuki and we'll work something out if you're feeling that that temptation that frankly happens with stress. So we understand, but we have these mechanisms in place so you can avoid it. So, Hello World was the first program we began with. I have to make this awkward transition now to Happy Time again. So we began looking in quite detail at first Scratch and then C, but it turns out you can do a bunch of things in all sorts of languages, and just so that you realize that the ideas we're talking about now are absolutely applicable to other languages and even the tail end of the same course, what I thought I'd do is just grab a couple of snippets of code. Oh, and actually, let me not take for granted this workflow. So I am on a Mac. I decide it's time to connect to the cloud.cs50.net, so I open on my Mac a program called Terminal. I can zoom in on my font size here. I'm going to type the command as the problem set one walks you through, cloud.cs50.net. I'm going to hit Enter, type in my password, and bam, now I am connected from my Mac to the remote server. For those of you with PCs, realize that the problem set actually walks you through the same process. You will see as the PSET directs, there are some how-tos, which is sort of geek speak for tutorials, user manuals, or whatnot, for both Terminal, which I just used, and if you're finding this a little too fast, realize we took nice screenshots and walk you through the exact same process and sequence of steps here. And just so you've seen it before, the half or so of you with PCs, realize that PuTTY is a free program that you can download off the internet. It is an SSH client. It looks a little different. It does have a more interesting GUI, graphical user interface, but at the end of the day, once you follow this sequence of steps, you end up seeing the same thing. The font might look a little different, but the result is actually the same. And those of you running Linux, frankly, probably know how to do this with your own computers anyway, but let us know if not. Yeah?
So why did you
Why did I tell the Mac? Oh, so why did I tell the Mac people to change your font colors and background? So when you read through this tutorial, we strongly suggest that you configure Terminal or configure PuTTY in a certain way so that graphically things look the same, and in terms of color coding, syntax highlighting, things look a little prettier. You do that on your Mac, but those settings then sort of put a lens in front of the server through which you look at your code. So it just changes the colors locally, but the effect is when you look at remote things, they too are different colors. That's all. Is it necessary? No. If you prefer just looking at the more generic white screen, that's certainly fine. And even I in lecture today am switching to white for readability's sake. It's really to each his or her own. It's up to you. But the structure is there. So I am now on the cloud. I'm going to go ahead into source. My source directory, which you have printouts of today. And what I thought I'd do is open up, for instance, this, which might make some of you feel more at home. So this is hi.java. So stupid name for a program, but this is a canonical program in Java. Some of you already know what this looks like. If you've ever wondered what Java source code looks like, it looks like this. Now there's a few different keywords. Oh, I didn't print this one out because it's so useless for moving forward. No, not as a language, just as an example. you'll see that the syntax kind of similar in spirit. There's a mention of main, there's parentheses, there's semicolons, there's close quotes, but there's some other jargon there. There's the word class, there's some additional bracket syntax here. So just realize that at the end of the day, this program too gets compiled in a similar way. Instead of running GCC, someone writing this program would run Java C, high.java, and then what you would do is run Java on this program high, and there is, in fact, the same program. I think I have another one here written in, let's say, high.php. Nope, that's not it. Okay, so here's perhaps the simplest PHP program you can write. And we'll be using PHP toward the tail end of the semester to actually implement things like isawyouharvard.com or any website-based application you'd like to make. You can kind of infer how this thing works. Echo sounds like it's pretty similar to print. The quotes and the backslash n are familiar. The semicolon's the same. There's some new syntax there with the open bracket and then the question mark. But again, the point of showing you these little teasers of other languages is that once you have a solid foundation in one language, maybe two languages or different types of languages, as might be covered in this course and follow-on courses, you can very easily bootstrap yourself to other environments. I mean, to be honest, I learned in 50 the language C. I took CS51 the next semester and learned a language called Lisp and C++ at the time. And that was it for my formal introduction to programming languages. Every other language I've learned since has been completely on my own and from friends and from projects and the like. So realize it's very empowering just getting your foot in that door. Well, what about this issue of imprecision? So let me go ahead and whip up a program like, let me take a look at this for one sec. So I'm going to go ahead and create with nano imprecision.c. This is not among your printouts because we're doing it in real time. First thing I'm going to start off with is include standard io.h. And what's the point of that? Quick sanity check. It gives me printf, right? So I can actually interact with standard input, the keyboard, and output, the screen, such as through printf. I'm going to say int, and we'll explain eventually why you say int. Main, I'm going to say void, because main at the moment does not take any arguments, but we'll soon peel back that layer. And I'm going to get myself ready to start coding by putting the curly braces there in advance. So now I'm going to do a couple of things. So I'm going to say float to get a floating point variable. X gets, let's say, 0.088, which just so happens to be a floating point value one of your classmates mentioned or before class when we were chatting. So it's a perfect example. We'll go with that one. Let's say float y equals, how about 0.01? And now float z is going to equal x plus y. So now to the astute mathematicians in the room, this value of z is now 0.89. At least it should be. Now let's make this more relatable to the actual piece set at hand. This is like change. So one of the problems in the problem set is, again, change making, where you have quarters, which might be 0.25, dimes, which might be 0.10, pennies, which might be 0.01. So surely there's an application already for floating point values. So suppose I'm trying to add 88 cents and 1 cent here to get 89 cents and then display this value. Well, let's do that. Let's do printf percent F for the floating point format string. If you don't remember these, as an aside, one of the best resources early on, if we don't mention things in the problem set at hand, if you go under C in the resources page of the course's website, one of the best references here is this thing called C reference. And all you have on the left-hand side are links to the categories of functions that come built into C. So for instance, if I'm dealing with printf, you should probably know intuitively now it has something to do with IO, right? Because it's standard IO. So if I follow this link and then scroll down, I'll see a whole bunch of functions we've not looked at yet. And we're not going to bother looking at all of these. You pick them up as you go. But there, in fact, is printf. And so here is some nice documentation with all the format codes for printf. There's some example code on this website, which is why we like it. And so this should help get you going as well if you feel that you didn't quite see the right approach in, say, some class. So here we go, percent %f. Let me do a new line f so that things don't blend onto multiple line, don't stay on the same line. Semicolon. Let me go ahead and quit with control X, Y for yes, enter for save. And now to compile this, I've got a few options. I'm going to start getting more efficient and just say, let make do it for me. Figure out all the flags, figure out the dash O and all of that mess, and hit enter. Okay, nothing bad seems to have happened, which presumably means something good happened. So now let's go ahead and run imprecision with ./imprecision. Okay, so that actually looks pretty good. Answer looks right. In fact, I seem to have gotten some free zeros at the end of it. But remember from last time that we can actually exercise a bit more discretion when it comes to seeing the places after that decimal point. And I can do that by saying dot, and let's say, let me see 10 decimal places. That was like 6 or 7 there. Let me go a little farther to the right and see what's really inside this variable z. I'm going to go ahead and hit Control X, Y, and Enter. I'm back at the prompt, and I'm going to rerun it. And yet, I see the same thing. Sanity check. All right, you have to recompile it, right? Again, sort of a neophyte mistake. You get used to it very soon. Let's remake this with imprecision. Enter. I've recompiled my code. Now if I rerun it, let me move the cursor to the top. Enter. Interesting. So that was kind of a lie. So when we've said before that computers only have a finite amount of memory and thus a finite amount of precision, which is another way of saying if you've only got a fixed number of bits, surely you cannot represent with a fixed number of bits, 32 or 64, the infinite number of real or rational numbers that exist in the world. So there's got to be some approximation going on, and there you have it. At 88 cents plus 1 cent, you do not, in fact, get 89 cents. You get just shy of 89 cents. So again, those of you who are fans of Office Space or Superman 3, this is the kind of stuff that they were literally referring to in that movie. These rounding errors, you start to add all that up after billions of transactions, and this is how these guys start to make some money. So why is this relevant? Well, suppose I add to this program a little condition. Again, just to hammer this home, if z is equal to 0.89, because that's a reasonable check to make, let me say printf and just say equal. I'm just doing a little bit of diagnostic work here. Now I'm going to say, let's say else if z is greater than 0.89, let me go ahead and printf, greater than 0.89, print greater, backslash n, else, let's go ahead and print f, it should be obviously less. I could say else if z is less than, but it's redundant. I can just say less because there's only three possible scenarios here. But I could, to be clear, say z less than 0.89, and we'll get the same result. So let's see what's actually going to print. Let's save, quit, remake it, rerun it, and in fact, it's less. So you'll see how to deal with this. Well, in the problem set, we walk you through the process of suggesting, well, you know what, if you've got floats and the problem is floats, well, why not work with cents? Why not work with ints? So what we propose very simply, and this does actually work out to solve this particular problem in this case, multiply those dollars, point cents, by 100, and what do you get back? Well, $1.99 becomes 199 pennies, and if you round appropriately, as you'll see in the spec, well, then it becomes 8.9, which is an actual int. But therein lies the reason. And this isn't quite the same bug, certainly, that resulted in the explosion of that rocket. But it's this kind of idea, not understanding what's really going on underneath the hood and understanding what the machine is doing for you and writing one stupid line of code and $300 million later, you've got a problem. Now, just to push back, in case you're thinking, well, this is ridiculous, I should come back in 20 years once mankind's gotten better at providing me with tools to avoid these problems, we have. So there are other languages, we get to them toward the tail end of the semester, but again, too many people don't understand these underlying implementation issues, and that's why we continue to have bugs and security holes, and more on that in just a bit. So where did the first bug come from? It was, as legend has it, actually a bug inside of a very old machine, one of which you can actually see in the Science Center, not the bug, but the machine, that big Mark I computer. Take a look, if you've never, at the little touristy plaques that are on it. It's quite a part of this school's and computing's history, but this is supposedly the first bug that was taped with like some cellophane tape by a computer scientist named Grace Hopper to a piece of paper in her lab notes documenting why the computer had malfunctioned that day. These days, bugs clearly has a different meaning, but derived from that spirit. So let's see if we can't take a look at a bug ourselves. I'm going to go ahead and open up buggy1.c. This is the first of the programs you do have a printout of. So if you'd like to follow along at home there, go ahead and take a look at this. Take, say, 30 seconds, 60 seconds, and decide for yourself and confirm with a partner what, in fact, the bug is with this thing here. And don't worry, we won't do this every time you have a question. All right. So short program, if you didn't catch this, it's okay. You'll very quickly get better at spotting these things. And one of our roles at office hours is to glance a code like this and be like, bam, unstick you and let you move along your way. What's the bug? Where is it? Hopefully alphabetically in the handout. Is it not there? It should be. Yeah. Buggy1.c. Okay, what's the bug? It's supposed to print 10 stars, but it does not because it actually prints... All right, it prints 11. All right, so this is, again, one of these newbie mistakes. You get used to it, too. And I point this out, again, never to poke fun, but because these are the kinds of stupid little bugs you trip over at first, you sink too much time into. So once you get past some of these frequently encountered bugs, can you really start focusing on the juicier problem. So the problem here is that I started counting at 0, like a good computer scientist or a computer, but I then went up to and equal to 10. So if you actually think through the iterations there, because recall that in a for loop, the initializations happen first on the left, the condition gets checked, then something happens, and then the incrementation or the update happens that will, in this case, actually print 11 stars. And so the fix could be a couple of things. The quickest fix, and perhaps the stylistically common fix, is to just do that. When you're iterating from something to something, you start at 0 and you go up to but less than that other value. If you really want to be more consistent with sort of normal human beings, we could absolutely count from 1 to 10 literally, but just realize that you probably shouldn't start this habit because there are some other features of programming languages, arrays being one of them, which we'll talk about this week, where you're just going to get yourself in trouble if you insist on counting like normal human beings. Start counting in this way. So let's take a look at a second little example here. Let's go ahead and look at buggy 2, which should follow that one. This one, too, is supposed to print 10 stars, but this time one per line because I whipped out a backslash n, but it does not. So little sanity check. What's the bug here? Right. So another frequently encountered issue, even though you've typed this code out so prettily, you've hit tab a couple times or the space bar to nicely indent things, it's very readable, seems consistent with the CS50 style guide, which is discussed in problem set 1. Unfortunately, the compiler only knows to execute one line of code after a for loop unless you have encapsulated it with curly braces like this and then one down here. So this would be correct if I want to print a star and then print a new line, print star, new line. But let's take a look at what actually happens if I go with the original version, which is just this one. So let me go ahead and make buggy 2. Then let me go ahead and run buggy 2. And in fact, they're all on the same line. But if I go back into nano, scroll down, and obviously I could just fix it like this, but we're demonstrating a little point here. So I could just go in here, put that curly brace, put this curly brace, save, quit, recompile, rerun, and there we go. Stupid program. One star, though, is now per line. And let me point out one thing, too, because when we get questions a lot of the time on help at cs50.net and the like, very commonly, we see code that clearly won't compile because you've got a semicolon over here, a parenthesis over here, and that's normal because it's a lot of new syntax for a lot of folks. But I can't emphasize enough, before diving in or before wondering wherein lies this problem, honestly, look back to some of the examples from last week or even this week. They're very short, very deliberately, so that you can actually look at them, get a sense of what correctly structured code is like. Literally look at this one and say, okay, it starts with int, main, then open curly brace, and just make sure you're mimicking that kind of syntax. And then you'll realize that there is some logical sense to this kind of structure. All right, so moving on to something more interesting involving typecasting, as that teaching fellow alluded to in his email to me. So typecasting is just this process of taking one data type like an int and casting it, converting it to a char, or vice versa. You can do this with a few different data types. We've talked about char to int, like a letter A going to 65 or 65 going to the letter A. This will be useful in applications of cryptography and other things. But you can even cast from a float to an int. You can take 1.99, put parenthesis int in front of that, and that casts it to an actual int. But what's the answer? So it's just one. You throw away everything after the decimal point, which may be what you want. In fact, as you'll see in the standard edition of the problem set for this week, we tell you that if you ever do have to round these bars when figuring out, their width, go ahead and round down so that it's not always 100% of the length. We tell you to round down, and if you need to round down, casting can do the trick. But we're going to see other data types before long. Certainly toward the tail end of the semester when we're implementing more sophisticated programs, we might want to implement the notion of a course, right? The Harvard Courses website for the CS50 app, we clearly have inside our server's memory the notion of a course, the notion of an instructor, the notion of a queue guide rating. There's all of these conceptual entities, and yes, we could represent all of those things with just numbers and strings and the like, but as we'll very soon see, you can make your own data structures. You can make your own data types. So if you want to actually represent the notion of a course, and a course has a name, a catalog number, and dot, 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 some other stuff, well, you can essentially join a whole bunch of variables together, call them something new, the course data type, and then start manipulating that. But if you choose to do that, typecasting doesn't mean you can take a course and cast it to a faculty member or vice versa. It has to actually make sense. And so in this context of primitives, where at the end of the day it's just bits, does it make sense sometimes to cast one thing to another? So let's take a look at ASCII1.c. So this too is among your printouts toward the beginning. Let me go ahead and scroll down here. And I've left the comments into this one, just because it's a few more lines of code. Feel free to mark it up if you'd like. But what does this actually do? Well, this is just to hammer home the point from week zero that if you want to represent letters and sentences and words on the screen, well, it turns out you can do this using just the underlying integer representations. But if you cast things to a char, you can very explicitly see that 65 is, in fact, capital A. 66 is, in fact, capital B, and so forth. And so what is this really going to do? Well, here we have a for loop. Certainly, by the time you've dived into problem set one, this kind of syntax will look more familiar. Even though we've started counting at zero before, it's totally legit if I want to start at a fixed value like this and iterate from 65 up to 65 plus 26. Now, arguably, this is a bit of a cheat. I just didn't want to do the math that late at night, so I just did the addition here because the computer can do it, but certainly could we add those together in advance and probably save ourselves some CPU cycles. What's going to happen here? Well, this line of printf prints a character followed by a colon and a space and then one or more digits. What am I putting in there? Well, I'm putting I both times. I'm plugging I into both of those placeholders, but I'm first telling the compiler, you know what? Treat I as a char. Treat it as a character so that what's printed is not 65 colon 65, but hopefully A colon 65. And as an aside, turns out it's not strictly necessary to explicitly cast or to explicitly say open parenthesis char, close parenthesis here. I'm doing it really just to be deliberate and clear. But the compiler or printf is really smart enough to know that it's this thing over here that dictates how those bits are rendered and not necessarily this. So realize that. As for the bottom half here, 97 happens to represent little a, 98 little b, and so forth. So there are charts that show you what these mappings are. But now, knowing 65 is big A, 97 is little a, we've got 52 letters, representations that we can figure out. And every other character on the keyboard has its own. So let's run this. Make ASCII1 seems to have compiled OK. Let's go ahead and run it. And what do I get? Well, just get a big, long chart showing me the so-called ASCII table. So we've pretty much scratched the surface of this verbally only, but A is 65, B is 66, dot, 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 T is 84, and then sure enough, little a down here is 97. All right, this is a pretty unwieldy program, right? If you spit out output like this, it's already annoying to me that I have to scroll up just to see what the program told me. Well, let's see if we can't do a little better. Let me go ahead and open the second version of this, so Nano ASCII 2, and scroll down. And notice I've done something a little differently here. Again, just a little trick, especially for something like problem set one or future p-sets where you want to start to control the aesthetics of your program a little more, not just dump stuff to the screen like printf makes so easy. Well, here, same kind of iteration, but what am I doing? Well, I'm printing out character, some white space, digits, some more white space, and then the 3D. What does this denote here? So three spaces. So I figured this out, frankly, by trial and error, or if I were more astute, I'd have sort of anticipated this. But once I get to the lowercase letters, starts at 97, then 98, 99, it eventually becomes three digits. So just to be anal and aesthetically pretty, I wanted to make sure that all those numbers take up three columns of text so that everything aligns nicely. So I eventually went back in and said, all right, make this 3D and not just D for reasons we'll see literally in a moment. Then we have another character. So what's over here? Well, let me scroll over to the right since the line's a little long. Actually, let me just scroll back, shrink the font a little bit. So what do we have here? The first placeholder is going to get the character equivalent of I. That's copy-paste from last time. Then literally I, copy-paste. Well, here I just did some trickery. I realized, well, you know what? A and big A and little a, they're always the same distance apart. They're always 32 characters apart, 65 to 97. So let me just do this all at once. The current value of I plus 32 will take me from the uppercase to the lowercase range. And then lastly over here, I'm casting to a char the result of doing that same calculation, I plus 32. So in the end, what do we have here? ASCII 2 Let's go ahead and run ASCII 2. Enter. So it's not perfect, right? My screen's a little small, my font's a little big, but now I feel like, okay, at least I'm now controlling this machine a bit more. So maybe a little underwhelming in the context of today's GUIs and whatnot, but again, the takeaway for now is control and specifying precisely to the machine what you want it to do for you. Any questions on this little ASCII exercise? Yeah? Good question. And when in doubt, we'll always try. So let's scroll down here, and let me get rid of what I thought was a fairly clever trick. Let me save, quit, recompile, and now rerun. And so, you know, it's not that bad. I'm being a little uptight here, but that's the problem I was trying to solve. I wanted to make sure each of those numbers took up three places and not just two, potentially. All right, so one last variant of ASCII. Let's scroll on down. And realize if you really have free time, you can transform these very basic primitives into the entirety of movies. Well, now notice two here. This isn't necessarily the way you should do things, but just to hammer home this point that at the end of the day, all we're doing is manipulating bits, zeros and ones. And we happen to group those bits as bytes, like a char is one byte, recall, an int is four bytes, recall, generally. Turns out we can even iterate over characters just to make all the more clear that there is this equivalence. I can iterate from the character C starting at capital A. I can do this as long as that's less than or equal to capital Z. And then I can do this incrementation. Again, here I'm being very deliberate with all of my parenthesization. The compiler does not need all of these hints necessarily. But notice, let's start on the inside of the parentheses, just like you would in sort of grade school math. If you've got lots of parentheses, focus on the deepest ones first. So here's C. I cast it to a number. Then I add 1, because again, the goal is to just start incrementing on each iteration. Then I don't want to print a number, I want to print a char, so I cast C back to a char, and then this line of code is the same. And at the end of the day, sure, you want to iterate and call it a character, that's fine. It's still just a byte. It's still just a number underneath the hood. Well, you might recall from childhood a game called Battleship. Now, I can't do justice to this game with my little command line programs yet, but I can print out the board thereof. So when you start implementing user interfaces where the user has to now see data and isn't really tolerant of just a blinking cursor and line after line of text, we could absolutely begin to implement what we would call graphical interfaces, albeit in a command line environment. So if you've never played this, this is essentially a plastic board you get as a kid. You've got numbers on the top, letters on the side, and you put these little ships inside these holes that I chose to represent with the lowercase zero there. What's interesting about this particular exercise is just how nicely formatted everything is, and also there's some kind of looping going on here. And that certainly might be a trick that proves handy in problem set one. Let's take a look for a moment at battleship.c. Turns out to print all that out, there's not all that much going on, but again, there's some decisions I need to make at each point. So I claim with this comment up here that I'm first going to print the top row of numbers. Well, first I print some white space, so a new line, just because I want to move it down a line, just because it looked prettier to me. I want to then indent three spaces, again, just to keep things pretty, but then what am I doing? Well, it looks like I'm just printing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 atop the little battleship board, like we saw. Well, then what do I do after that? Just a new line. So this byte of the problem I've taken out first just prints the row of numbers. And so this is, again, to echo the point from last week, especially when you're diving into PSET 1, do not try to implement the entirety of the Skittles problem, the entirety of the change-making problem, the entirety of the I saw you program, because inevitably you'll have one or two or three bugs, but when you have to chase them down all together, it just adds unnecessary complexity and wastes time. Start by just implementing the numbers, save, compile, run, looks good, now move on to the next part. That next part is this. Print the rows of holes, represented by lowercase o, with letters in the leftmost column. So I had to do some thinking here. Now I don't want to print one row. I've got to print one row, then another, then another, then another. But in each row, I kind of have to iterate this way. So I have to go this way and then this way. So that suggests looping in two different directions. Well, you can absolutely, as you could in Scratch, loop using nested loops, using while, do while, or for loops. I decided to go with for here, and as follows. So for int I gets 0 up to 10. So this loop here, is this controlling the cursor's top-down movement or left-right movement, would you say? So it is, in fact, top-down. Now, why is that? Well, on each iteration of the outer loop, just conceptually, you're probably going to print, as we've seen printf behave before, one line at a time. So to print this and this and this and this, that's got to happen on the inside, because only once I've printed this and this and this am I allowed to wrap around to the new line, and that's the role being played by this outer loop. So indeed, this outer loop, I, represents the rows, not the columns per se. Now what am I doing here? I'm printing out a character placeholder followed by literally A plus I. So here I started to understand that I know that this cast can happen. I don't have to be so explicit anymore. So this is going to print A when I is 0, B when I is 1, C when I is 2, because you're just adding 65 plus that value. Then what do I print next? Well, I just need to print 10 of these holes in the board. And so I print a lowercase o, space, space, to line things up. Then a new line eventually. Notice that it's not inside the for loop, it's at the end, nor is this thing inside the for loop, it's at the end. And the end result is to print this, 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 but before you advance to the next line, you're going this, da 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 da, this, da 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 da, and so you get this looping structure. And this is very similar in spirit to perhaps to a little something that you might do, for instance, in, say, a picture like this. Why don't we go ahead and take a 5-minute break? All right. So we are back. Let me verbally answer two frequently just asked questions. So some of you noticed that all of a sudden I started making main look way more complicated than it used to be by including int, argc, char, star, argv, brackets. So the reason for this is that this week will we start teasing apart what a string actually is. Thus far we've talked about a string as being a word, hello, a sentence, or whatnot, but ultimately it's a sequence of chars, and so it turns out programs like that you write that have main functions can take strings, can take words as arguments themselves. So this is a foreshadowing of exactly the syntax we're going to start using this week and beyond. It's a little more sophisticated than just saying void, but it's useful when you actually want to take input from the user the moment they run the command. Case in point, you've been running GCC, or soon will. You've been using Nano, or soon will. Those programs take what we've been calling command line arguments. Nano, hello.c. Make, hello. So that word has to somehow be handed into your program, and the means by which we're going to empower you to hand inputs, words, strings, and the like, at the command line to your programs is by way of these inputs to main, the thing inside the parentheses. But we'll come back to that before long. As another FAQ, I suddenly seem to have stopped using double quotes and instead using single quotes. The reason for this, again, reduces to an issue of types. When I'm using double quotes as an argument, as an input to printf, so that is a string, what we've been calling it. A string, recall from last week, is just a sequence of chars, a sequence of characters. When you have just one character and you want to be sure that that one character is, in fact, being represented with just 8 bits, a single byte, must you use single quotes around it? If you don't, as we'll see next week and perhaps this Wednesday, if you don't, that's A, if you use double quotes, will actually be treated as a string, or really a one-character word, a one-character sentence, and that has implications for how much memory is being used and also for potentially the security of the information being stored there. Ah, good question. When you are printing backslash n, can you use single quotes? No, this needs to go inside of double quotes. So I have been very particular in using my double quotes and single quotes, and pretty much you should, is this a safe generalization? Almost always use double quotes unless you know what you want to print is an individual char and you've hard-coded it into the program as such. All right, so a little bit of a familiar, if annoying, song. So I needed something that had a lot of cyclicity in it, just repeats ad nauseum, and something ideally that starts counting downward. So you have this song the kids used to sing on the school bus, for instance, and what's interesting is that there's a couple of changes that happen over time. With each annoying verse of this song, the 99 becomes 98, 98 becomes 97, and you count down to 1 or 0 or whatever. But notice, too, inside of each inside of each verse, there is a change in, let's call it, I itself. It doesn't happen on every loop. It actually happens inside the verse itself. And then if I really want to be anal, this last line when I say something bottles of beer on the wall, when I get down to 1, I probably want to fix the English so that it just says 1 bottle of beer on the wall. So it seems like there's an opportunity for a condition, an if-else there, even though it's only useful at the very tail end of that program. So let's go ahead and open up a little program called beer1.c, the first incarnation of this. I'm again using CS50's library. And what's going on here in this program? So the first thing I've decided to do is ask the user for a number. All right, how do I do that? Well, I literally use printf and ask them for a number. Then I use getInt from CS50's library. And recall that getInt is a function. And a function is kind of this black box that might take input, doesn't have to, but might take input and might return output. And if it does, in fact, return output that you care about, you better do something with it. In this case, you better store that return value, that output, in a variable n so we can use it later. Now, here's what we'll start calling error checking or rigorous error checking. And you won't necessarily see us specify pedantically in every problem set, check for this, check for that, make sure the user can't do this. This should become natural before long. If you are writing a program that takes any form of user input, it is ultimately and should be up to you to make sure that that user's input cannot in any way break your program. It's not an excuse to say, oh, well, they shouldn't have inputted a negative number. I mean, case in point, not to overemphasize the explosion of that rocket ship, you make assumptions and bad things eventually happen, especially when lots of people or lots of users become involved. So I'm doing a sanity check here. If the user has typed in an int, which is allowed by getInt, but that int is zero or negative, I don't want to deal with this user, so I'm simply going to say, sorry, that makes no sense. And then I'm going to return 1. So this is a piece of new syntax. It turns out that when you are writing a function, which we are, this thing called main, functions have or can have return values. And this is, again, the point I was just making. The return value of getInt is what data type, presumably. So it's an int. And, you know, I kind of have been waving my hands at it. What's the return type of main? It's been always int, even though I've not used this explicitly. So it turns out that even the function called main, which is the one you have to start your programs with in C, even it has a return value. Now, thus far, every program I've written has had a return value. Every implementation of main that I've written actually has returned a value, but it's returned implicitly a value of 0. So if you don't specify a return value, at least in main, the value of 0 is just assumed, so you don't have to waste time and effort actually coding it at the very bottom of your function. Now, why is this useful? Well, there's a lot of things that can go wrong when you write a program. And we've seen visually an example of that. We've certainly seen a couple of buggy examples today of that. So the idea that a program or a function can return a value is useful because it's its only mechanism for informing the programmer or the human, the user, that or whether or that something went wrong. So 0 is good. 0 means nothing went wrong. I'm not even going to tell you that nothing went wrong. You should just assume that nothing went wrong. But unfortunately, with programming and with computers, can we make a heck of a lot of mistakes? Dare say, as many as 4 billion possible mistakes exist when it comes to programming. Even that is technically an oversimplification. But this is good because 0 means good. And I can assume that 0 pretty much always means success. You return 0, good stuff happened. But in case you made any number of the billion possible mistakes someone can make, you've got a billion other integers you can return so that you can signify those errors. Now, I'm exaggerating. Hopefully, you're not hand error checking for a billion different things in a program. Usually, you check for 1 or 2 that can actually happen. But the point here is this. I've decided arbitrarily by human convention, if this thing goes wrong, I'm going to return this so-called sentinel value, just a special arbitrary number, the number 1. Why? Because it's different from 0. And that's really all it is. Now, if you've ever been using your Mac or your PC, and you all of a sudden get some pop-up that says an error has occurred or it freezes, very often in these little dialog windows do you see a number. Maybe it's positive, maybe it's negative. It generally means nothing to you, but guess who it does mean something to? Right, the programmer, right? The person at Microsoft, Apple, wherever, who wrote it. So not all that useful for you, right? Unless you maybe call tech support and tell them what you're seeing on the screen. But these error codes, these return codes, are generally used by the developer, the programmer, to actually understand what's going wrong. So here, by convention, I'm returning 1. Really, this program is so simple, it doesn't matter what I return. But again, convention, return a non-zero value. All right, so let's assume that the user's not being difficult, and I'm proceeding to sing this annoying song. So I'm going to print a new line first, just for aesthetic reasons. And it turns out this program's not that hard to implement. Let me go ahead and iterate from I equals, oh, this is interesting. So even though thus far, just by habit, I've been incrementing from 0 on up or 1 on up, there is nothing stopping you from doing it in the reverse direction. In fact, here, because conceptually I'm starting at 99 and going on down, I don't want to confuse myself by starting the loop at 0 but printing the opposite, 99. Let's just start at 99. So int I gets 99 or whatever the value of n is. I'm going to sing this song so long as I is greater than 0. Maybe the song's supposed to end at 0 or 1. I wasn't sure. So I said, keep going until it's 0. We definitely don't want to go negative. And then on each iteration, do I minus minus. And this, recall, is shorthand notation. We saw plus plus even as far back as our sock changing example. But really, this is shorthand notation for I gets, the assignment operator, I minus 1. Right? Or if you do the plus plus, that's equivalent to I gets I plus 1. Or there's yet other shorthand notation you might see in online resources or the TF's code or in books. You can do I minus equals 1 to decrement or I plus equals 1 to increment. Frankly, this is why most people just do I plus plus or minus minus, because it's much more straightforward. As an aside, there is also a minus minus operator and a plus plus operator. In many contexts, they do the same thing. In some contexts, they don't. We'll see over time when and if you should actually care. But generally, put it after and you'll be pretty safe. So let's take a look at this song. It's got 4 lines, print some number of bottles. And notice here, I'm already kind of taking a shortcut. I didn't want to have to write too much code. What's my cheat here? Yeah, bottles, like, yeah, cut this corner, right? So it's not wrong grammatically. It's just the parentheses are only useful eventually. So we'll get there, right? Baby steps. So the first line is print some number of bottles of beer on the wall, and then I'm inserting to that format string, that placeholder, I. So it's some number of bottles of beer, same thing, comma, I. Take one down, pass it around. That's just text. So notice printf, again, doesn't have to take any commas or anything after it. Now I have to do a little bit of math, but not much. Some number of bottles of beer on the wall, but here I want to do the decrementation. So now, is there a risk that I'm actually going to say negative 1 at any point? Disagreement, so push back. How is this happening? Well, let's see. There's a loop here. We're starting at n, so we're definitely starting big. But I'm checking this condition on every iteration, is I greater than 0? So it's only going to be the case, even at the very last iteration, that I has to be greater than 0. So on my very last pass through this loop, I is going to be minimally, so 1. So if I is 1, I think I'm safe. So 1 gets printed here, because it's I. 1 gets printed here, because it's I. 1 gets printed here, or rather, no. 0 gets printed here because it's I minus 1. But recall what happens with a for loop after each iteration. You don't go back to the left of this thing. Essentially, it's the update that happens. I becomes 0. The condition is checked. And so, in fact, we are safe. So it's close, but we are, in fact, safe because I'm stopping so long as I is greater than or equal to 0. The error would be if I did something like this or any other number of logical quirks. So now, what's one difference toward the end of this program? Well, at the end, I decide to exit. And now, because I've used a non-zero return value, technically, I don't need this return 0 because 0 will be assumed. But as a matter of good style, if I'm going to start taking the trouble to return values explicitly, let's be consistent and actually return 0 at the end. For all intents and purposes, certainly in this course, it's not generally going to matter. But when your programs do get larger and more sophisticated, is this a very useful habit to already be in? But let's see if we can't. Well, let's actually sing the song. So let's go. Well, that would be awkward. But let's just do the program version. Make beer. Let's run this first. So make beer 1. Let's go ahead and run beer 1. How many bottles will there be? Well, it's not going to fit on the screen, but let's try it. 99. And sure enough, if I scroll back up in time, there's a whole lot of iteration going on. Seems to check out at the top. 99 goes down to 98, then 97. And at the very bottom, 0 bottles of beer on the wall. So not a great program, because I'm totally cutting corners with this parenthesization of the S. It's not bad. Yeah. Oh, good question. When in doubt, let's just answer it definitively. So let's go ahead and do what's pretty reasonable. Maybe I'm not even quite sure early on of the logic, so let's resave that. Go down, that's not correct. Greater than or equal to, so the syntax follows the English, greater than or equal to 0. So I argue this is going to take us one step too far. It will compile. So this is not a compilation error. This is a logical error. This is a programming conceptual mistake, not a syntax error. So let me go ahead and now rerun beer 1. Doesn't matter what it is. I could do 199. It's still going to run fast. And in fact, now I see this aesthetic quirk. So I see, in fact, a negative 1, because percent %d just means one or more digits, whether positive or negative. Yeah? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. I misunderstood. So let's do that too. So let me go back and let's just rerun it with this. So negative 99 beers. I should catch that because of my if condition. My error checking at the top of the function.
Wait,
Okay, so this is where I say, for all intents and purposes, it doesn't matter in this course because you don't see the return values. But in a week or two's time, you're going to find that printf as a debugging tool, a tool with which to find mistakes in programs, is only so useful. When your programs get start taking input from users and you might have a lot of variables in mind, you can't just rely on printf as a useful tool. So we're going to start using what's called a debugger, something called GDB. You may recall from last week, I just mentioned terribly briefly that there's this other flag, GDB, that includes some special stuff in your program when you compile it. Well, long story short, we're going to get to the point very soon of not only being able to run programs you write, but be able to run them in a simulation mode whereby you can step through your own code line by line by line, interact with it, change it, and in that context will be more useful to know what the return value is because you'll be able to see it in that simulator. So it's a good question. In the first one, it's not really necessary. You're welcome to, so long as you're consistent with these lessons. Return zero, for instance, by default. But at some point soon, will you need to get to that point? And if you are, in fact, already in problem set one, doing any error checking, which you might very well be to check the number of skittles that are in the machine and so forth, then absolutely start returning one, then two, then three to represent arbitrarily your various return values. But again, and we'll talk more about some of these details in section. But let's introduce a pretty bad bug here. So let me go back into beer1.c. Let me scroll on down. And you know what? Let's actually omit this error check at the very top. So let me save that. And actually, let me fix the other mistake so we're not changing too many things at once. I'm going to go back to the original. But notice I've not done my original check. Save. Recompile beer1. Rerun beer 1, 99, seems to work. Let's try negative 99. Okay, so it's not quite right, right? So in fact, let's make one other mistake just to see how well we can really break the cloud here. So let's actually suppose that I goof and I do while I is less than 0. So let's recompile. And again, this bang trick I'm doing, again, exclamation point XYZ will execute the last command that started with XYZ. So let me recompile this. Oh, and this is another message. If you get this and I just want to recompile my program, well, you already did, is what that message is telling you. All right, that one's come up before too. So let's rerun beer 1, 99 bottles. Okay, I've really broken this. Now let's be difficult. Negative 99. So what's going to happen? Can we reason through what's going to happen? So yeah, that's a lot of ideas. So a couple of things could happen. One, the assumption you have to make is this is an int, right? Even though I'm messing around with the input, it's still an int. And we know an int, like any data type in a computer, is going to be a finite size, probably 32 bits, maybe 64 bits, but in this case, 32 bits. The biggest negative number we can represent with an int is... So negative 2 billion. So and frankly, we might be here a while if we keep waiting for this thing to go. But eventually, you're going to go to negative 2 billion, and then you're going to keep going a little too much. And what's going to happen? You're not going to overflow to another int in memory. What's going to happen if you only have 32 bits, and now you're at the point of representing the biggest negative one possible? It's probably something's going to change, right? If you're just flipping zeros and ones, a zero becomes a one, a one becomes a zero, just like the board exercise we did and the hands being raised the other day. If you only have so many permutations of hands in the air or zeros and ones on the board, well, eventually, if you keep adding one, you're probably going to wrap around. It's wrong, but you're going to wrap around from what appears to be a negative number to what's an arbitrary positive number, probably positive 2 billion, and you'll get in this loop. Now, this really will take a while, so let's see if we can't speed up this bug. Why don't we, instead of doing this, we could do minus equals, how about 1,000 at a time? This program's 1,000 times faster now. Negative 99. Let's see if that's fast enough. No, that's still going to take a while. Let's do... That's pretty fast. All right. Let's recompile, rerun, be difficult again. Okay. I fixed it, right? It stopped. So it didn't go positive, it seems. I lied, right? Right. So it did become positive, right? The only condition in which this song ends and says, wow, that's annoying, is when that condition is no longer true. But the condition I just changed was to be sure that I is always less than 0. So logically, if this program stopped, and I didn't kill it with like control C, it just stopped on its own and said, wow, that's annoying, it must be that I became 0. And in fact, it did. It simply wrapped around back to a positive value. The condition exited. So it kind of fixed the program's execution, but it didn't fix the logical error at hand. And so you have the correct version. I have made a complete mess of this particular version. But the takeaway here is, again, not only do computers have a finite amount of precision, they also have a finite amount of capabilities when it comes to storing a large or potentially large number. Let me point out one little teaser, if I may. I pulled up this website in advance. Some of you might have a PS3 or Wii or Xbox. If you have a Wii, you can crack these things. There's this so-called homebrew club that allows you to do fun things with your Wii. And I thought I would read this. And it's related to this idea of computers only having so much finite memory space. And we'll see more on this when we discuss arrays. How the Zelda TP exploit works, stack buffer overflow. During a stack buffer overflow, a program writes outside of the intended program data structure in the memory address. So not the same problem we just induced, but definitely related to this idea of finite storage and maybe not checking if we're using memory that doesn't belong to us. This is used in the Twilight hack. So this is the Twilight Zelda game, so for the familiar. When you're in a game, a lengthy name of Epona, the horse, is used to generate a stack overflow. This occurs during the conversation with the man when you load your save, when he loads the name in the dialogue box, or when you are entering the next zone where you have to ride a horse. Which is to say, we will start Wednesday's lecture not with an explosion, but with this particular gaming error. See you then.